This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.partaday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu ربيون كثير فما وهنوا لما أصابهم في سبيل الله وما ضعفوا وما استكانوا والله يحب وما كان قولهم إلا أن قالوا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا رافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا حسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord? So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Hamas welcomes adoption of Gaza ceasefire resolution by the UN Security Council, stressing the need for a permanent ceasefire and withdrawal of Israeli forces. Iran says UN Security Council's Gaza ceasefire resolution is a positive but inadequate step, and the regime must be held accountable for its crimes. And UN human rights expert says Israel has committed acts of genocide in Gaza and its plans to forcibly displace Palestinians amounts to ethnic cleansing. Our top story for this half hour: the United Nations Security Council has passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip.
Will those in favor of the draft resolution contained in document S/2024/254 please raise their hand? The result of the voting is as follows: 14 votes in favor, 0 vote against, 1 abstention. The draft resolution has been adopted as Resolution 2728/2024.
The draft resolution was jointly submitted by the current 10 non-permanent members of the Council. 14 countries, including 4 permanent members of the UN body, voted in favor of the resolution, except the United States, that abstained from voting. The actual draft demanded an immediate ceasefire in the holy month of Ramadan, leading to a permanent sustainable ceasefire in Gaza. But the Russian representative, in a statement before the vote, said that the word permanent was omitted before the meeting. Over the past 5 months since Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza, Washington has vetoed 3 draft resolutions on the Gaza ceasefire, sparking condemnations at home and abroad. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has welcomed the adoption of the UN Security Council resolution for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. In a statement, Hamas stressed the need for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza that leads to the withdrawal of all Israeli forces from the territory and the return of displaced Gazans to their homes. The resistance movement also expressed readiness for a deal securing the release of Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails in exchange for Israeli captives held in Gaza. It also called for the delivery of all humanitarian supplies needed in the besieged strip. Hamas further urged the UN Security Council to pressure the Israeli regime to observe the ceasefire in Gaza and stop the genocide of Palestinians. Palestinian ambassador to the UN, Riyad Mansour, has hailed a Security Council resolution on the Gaza ceasefire, expressing hope that the move will put an end to Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people.
This must be a turning point. This must lead to saving lives on the ground. This must signal the end of this assault of atrocities against our people. A nation is being murdered. A nation is being dispossessed. A nation is being displaced for decades now, but never at this scale since the Nakba. Never this openly, from Tantura to Gaza, from 1948 to 2024. Mr. President, now that this council has finally called for a ceasefire, all forces should coalesce to make sure it is enforced. Apologies to those who the world has failed, to those that could have been saved and were not. save the lives of those who survived against all odds. Tell them help is on the way. Hold accountable those who inflicted such suffering upon them. End this injustice. End it now. All of this is long overdue. And I thank you very much, Mr. President.
Well, Iran has welcomed the adoption of Gaza's immediate ceasefire resolution by the UN Security Council as a positive, though inadequate, step. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said what is more important than passing the resolution is taking effective measures to enforce it and end Israel's attacks on Gaza and the occupied West Bank. He added that lifting Israel's siege of Gaza, sending extensive humanitarian aid and international funding of Gaza reconstruction are other important steps that must be taken. Kanani said Israel's reaction to the resolution shows how angry it is about the irreparable defeat that the regime has suffered in political and international arenas. He said the Security Council must hold Israel accountable for the crimes it has committed against Palestinians during the past 6 months. 6 months into the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza, the regime's forces continue to pound homes, refugee camps, and aid convoys, resulting in the death of more civilians in the besieged Palestinian Strip.
We became running and found the houses, as you see, destroyed and flattened, and we began the process of bringing out the wounded, survivors, and martyrs. Unfortunately, there is no safe place in the Gaza Strip. There are houses of displaced people and civilians who have nothing to do with anything. The ruthless enemy has left no safe place in Gaza.
At least 107 civilians have lost their lives in the Israeli bombing and shelling campaign over the past 24 hours. 32 people were killed in Israeli airstrikes on residential buildings in the southern city of Rafah alone. Also, a house was bombed in the central Gaza city of Deir al-Bala, leaving at least 18 people dead there. According to media reports, Israeli attacks on the vicinity of al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City also caused a number of casualties. Areas surrounding Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis were shelled as well. Regime forces have laid siege to several hospitals, preventing medical supplies from reaching them. The Israeli onslaught on Gaza that began in early October has so far claimed more than 32,300 lives and injured nearly 75,000 others. Moti Abu Mosabe joined us from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Bala to update us on the situation. While reporting live, more Palestinian dead bodies were seen arriving at Al-Aqsa Hospital. Let's take a listen to how Gazans are struggling with the catastrophic condition.
According to Gaza's health ministry, that the Israeli occupation forces over the last 24 hours committed at least 11 appalling massacres against the Palestinian civilians across all areas of Gaza Strip, claiming the lives of at least 107 Palestinian civilians and injuring roughly 176 others. These numbers are rising incrementally with the continuous and the ongoing Israeli attacks and airstrikes and incursions that are still covering all areas of Gaza Strip. Here in Deir al-Bala city and in the central area of Gaza Strip, particularly over the last couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes attacked Al-Mughraga neighborhood, claiming the lives of six Palestinian civilians. More civilian cars are bringing more Palestinian casualties left behind that airstrike. The ambulances are dispatched these moments. Apparently, there is multiple casualties left behind that airstrike. It was a huge airstrike. Yes, evidently, it is another massacre. Took place moments ago in Deir al-Bala city, particularly the surrounding areas, the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. So the current situation is catastrophic and chaotic. Here is another civilian car bringing more Palestinian casualties. So this is the current situation so far. This is what is happening these moments in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital.
A UN rights expert says there are reasonable grounds to determine that Israel has committed acts of genocide and ethnic cleansing in its onslaught on Gaza. Francesca Albanese is UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territory. She said in a report that Israel has violated three of the five acts listed under the International Genocide Convention. The expert added that the overwhelming scale of Israel's attacks on Gaza reveals the regime's intent is to physically destroy Palestinians as a group. Albanese also asserted that statements by senior Israeli officials about forcible displacement of Palestinians and replacing them with settlers amount to ethnic cleansing. Albanese's report is due to be presented to the UN Human Rights Council on Tuesday. Moving on, Israeli troops have launched new incursions into several areas across the occupied West Bank, abducting a number of Palestinians. The regime's forces raided the cities of Jenin, Nablus, Qalqilia, and Beit Fajar, among others. In Jenin, they raided homes in a number of neighborhoods and deployed snipers on rooftops as clashes broke out with resistance groups. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers also assaulted several Palestinians, raided homes, and targeted vehicles in Beit Amer as Israeli forces stormed the town. A Palestinian was also shot in the Balata refugee camp on the outskirts of Nablus. Palestinian resistance fighters confronted Israeli forces across the West Bank, targeting them with explosive devices. Our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with details on attacks by Israeli forces and settlers that have become daily occurrences in the occupied West Bank.
Let's start with the occupied West Bank, specifically Al-Khalil. The Israeli forces stormed Beit Umar, northern Al-Khalil, and arrested at least two Palestinians from there. Before the Israeli troops stormed Beit Umar, Israeli settlers had raided Beit Umar town and attacked Palestinians and threw stones at the vehicles as well as the homes, as well as smashed the windows of the homes, the windshields of the vehicles. The Israeli settlers claimed that Palestinians from inside the village of Beit Umar opened fire at the nearby Israeli settlement Kermit Sur, and one of the bullets had hit a house there, according to the Israeli settlers. So that's why they claim they attacked the people there. Then the Israeli forces themselves stormed the area and detained Palestinians from inside Beit Umar, as well as preventing any movement to the village or out of the village. The Israeli forces also raided the cities of Doura and Yatta, south Al-Khalil, and attacked Palestinians there, arrested a number of people, set up more checkpoints preventing any movement to inside or outside those cities south Al-Khalil.
Jordanians have once again attended a rally to express solidarity with Palestinians and denounce Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. They also demanded the government shut down Israel's diplomatic mission in the country.
The message and will of our Jordanian people and youth. Today, the embassy of shame, the Zionist embassy that defiles our capital Amman, should be closed. It should end. We won't back down. We won't get tired. We won't stop until they shut down the embassy of shame, the Zionist embassy in Amman.
Waving Palestinian and Jordanian flags and chanting slogans, protesters marched to the heavily fortified Israeli embassy in Amman. Police forces clashed with the protesters and fired tear gas to disperse them. According to eyewitnesses, several protesters were beaten up and some of them were arrested during the clashes. Jordanians often assemble in front of Israeli and American embassies to express their anger at the ongoing bloodshed in Gaza. Jordan, that is hosting 2.4 million Palestinian refugees, has witnessed several such rallies in support of Gazans since Israel launched its war on the besieged Gaza Strip. The leader of Ansar al-Movement has praised the Yemeni nation's resilience and unity in the face of the Saudi-led coalition's aggression. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the people of Yemen. Houthi was speaking in a televised address marking the ninth anniversary of the Saudi-led war on Yemen. He denounced the Saudi-led aggression as an unjustified and treacherous war whose goal was to destroy Yemen, occupy it, and undermine the right of its people to freedom and independence. Houthi said the aggression resulted in the death or injury of over 50,000 civilians, mostly women and children. Ansar's leader said the Saudi-led aggression was part of a larger geopolitical strategy pursued by the U.S., U.K., and Israel to reshape the region for the benefit of the Zionist regime. He rather affirmed that despite the extensive damage to Yemen's infrastructure and high civilian toll, the nation's spirit remains unbroken. Houthi pledged Yemen will further develop its indigenous military capabilities and economy. He called on certain countries to reassess their miscalculations and aggressive policies towards Yemen. U.S. occupation forces have carried out a series of airstrikes against targets in eastern Syria near the border with Iraq. Reports say American warplanes carried out 10 simultaneous strikes on residential neighborhoods and military installations in Deir al-Zawr province, including the cities of Deir al-Zawr, al-Mayadeen, and al-Bukamal. They say at least 20 people, including women and children, were injured in the attacks. No more details have been provided so far. The United States regularly conducts airstrikes in Syria under the pretext of fighting terrorism. Damascus has written numerous letters to the UN calling on the world body to put an end to U.S. attacks and its military presence in the Arab country. Russian President Vladimir Putin says Kremlin knows who carried out the recent terrorist attack in Moscow, but it wants to find out who ordered it.
We also see that the United States, through various channels, is trying to convince its satellite countries and other countries of the world that, according to their intelligence, there is allegedly no trace of Kiev in the terrorist attack in Moscow, that the bloody terrorist attack was committed by members of Daesh. We know by whose hand this atrocity against Russia and its people was committed, but we want to know who ordered them to do it.
Putin stressed that the assailants tried to flee to Ukraine, adding that there are many questions to be examined. He said the attack may be just a link in a whole series of attempts by those who have been at war with Russia since 2014 through the neo-Nazi regime in Kiev. Putin reiterated that the attack was meant to sow panic among Russians. Four gunmen burst into Moscow's Crocus City Hall on Friday and began shooting at the people who attended a concert. They killed nearly 140 people and injured over 180 others. 11 people, including the attackers, have been detained and are facing terrorism charges. Ukraine has denied any role in the attack. And that's a wrap for now, but stay tuned. Bye for now, everybody.
Is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Ayahs, 30 days. A monotheist person not only reflects on the noble Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors, peace be upon them. Every faithful person, too, according to the extent that they had learnt from the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, embarked on this heavy duty. So the ulama, or Muslim scholars, took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job until present day. Today, this duty has become even more important because of a broad assault by the enemies against Islamic beliefs and humanity. In the 15th episode of our Ramadan special series, we're going to dwell upon the topic of victory of truth and defeat of falsehood, with a focus on Ayah 81 of Surah Al-Asra of the Holy Quran. Please stay with us. You may have heard that the Prophet of Islam said in part of his sermon on the virtues of the blessed month of Ramadan, "Devils are in chains in this month, so appeal to your Lord not to make them dominate over you. Devils are handcuffed and chained in this month to allow the servants of Allah to gain more of his banquet, to let them to recite Allah's book with contemplation. Devils are chained so that the Muslims pay more attention to their brothers in faith and all downtrodden oppressed people all over the world. Being in chain will weaken devils and their chief, Satan, in deceiving servants. Allah mentions a general law in Ayah 81 of Surah Al-Isra in the Holy Quran whilst addressing the Prophet. And say, the truth has come and falsehood is bound to vanish. Principally, falsehood is perishable by nature. Falsehood may show off as powerful for a while, but ultimately it won't stay, as victory is with the truth and its followers. This ayah speaks of a general principle and a definite divine tradition. Truth is the ultimate victor of all confrontations with falsehood. Falsehood may have an outward power and glory, but it is short-lived, and it will certainly perish. The reason for this is that falsehood is not in compliance and harmony with the laws and regulations of the universe. Falsehood is opposed to the laws of creation. It is fake and fabricated, but the truth is in the full compliance with the laws and regulations of creation. It is a matter of regret that every Muslim does not believe in this reality. However, falsehood dominating the world today is not everlasting, and it will soon perish, inshallah, God willing. Many people do not believe that the domineering system is bound to perish is because the main symbol of the system, the United States, keeps manifesting itself as powerful, indomitable and everlasting through propaganda and through media campaigns and enthralling the minds and hearts of the public. This is being done through the media, especially cinema and news agencies. Yet, a brief look at history and the current circumstances make it quite clear that this system is in decline. Britain was a country whose colonialism expanded from east to the west after the Industrial Revolution. This country ruled a vast empire in history, dominating a fifth of the world's population. It was said that the sun would never set on the British Empire. Britain had almost all commercial routes in its control. It had an invincible army and the largest navy in the world. Thus, no crime and massacring would occur anywhere in the world without some sort of British involvement. For instance, in the years 1917 to 1919, half of the Iranian population were killed with an artificial famine and imposed disease, especially cholera, which were the conspiracies of the British Kingdom in Iran. India had perhaps suffered more than any other country at the hands of the British colonialists. The British committed every sort of crime and massacre in the Indian subcontinent and pillaged that country for a century and a half. Amritsar tragedy was just one of these crimes. The British massacred 60,000 freedom-seeking peaceful Indians in a place called Jallianwala Bagh on 13th of April 1919 in the province of Punjab. In northwest India, British forces fired and massacred all these innocent Indians in cold blood. However, the heinous crime led to the end of the British Empire. For sure, Britain today is no longer a powerful country, and it is currently grappling with innumerable economic problems, political and social crises. This has gone to the extent that even tiny countries, which used to be British colonies, have announced their independence from Britain. So not only the sun has set on the British Empire, but the empire itself is in decline. The United States of America, a country which turned into a superpower after the Second World War and built up NATO with the collaboration of its allies, has waged innumerable wars and committed unprecedented crimes across the world. The United States, which the founder of the Islamic Republic, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, fittingly named as the Great Satan, started the huge expedition in West Asia with the spurious scenario of 11th of September 2001, the scenario which was an inside job, according to many researchers, evidence and confessions of many politicians and experts. At that time, many pundits predicted a very dark and bleak era for the region, in which the United States would become more powerful and mightier through looting of the natural resources of the West Asia region. But the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, maintained another point of view on regional developments. The Secretary General of the Lebanese Islamic Resistance Movement, Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said about this differing viewpoint, "The US started expedition in the region in a way that other countries were assured that the region had entered the American age, and regional nations should witness the dominance and rule of the United States in the Middle East. They were even getting prepared for one or two countries of the U.S. rule in the region and new wars like the Crusades. At that time, I took a trip to Iran and went to visit Ayatollah Khamenei to ask for his view on regional events and U.S. entering the Middle East. At that time, the conditions were so critical that some Iranian officials came to him and consulted him on establishing relations with the United States, saying, we should seek compromise and reconciliation with the United States. Due to his strategic viewpoint, Ayatollah Khamenei would reject these requests and stress that the circumstances were not to the benefit of the Americans. Don't worry, the United States has reached its climax, and from now on, we should expect the fall and decline of this country, particularly failure in its designs in this region. Today, God's promise of the defeat of falsehood is visible more than ever before in many nations, even in Europe, and they're seeking to separate themselves from declining US power. For example, the European Union has tried since 2013 to attain independence from the United States, and this has expanded to the political and economic realms as well. The President of France, Emmanuel Macron, in March of 2024 said the European Union should stop hanging on to the US, since the big threat for Europe is to be trapped in crises that are not ours.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we evaluate a trending news story and we break it down from an Islamic perspective. With Muslims observing the holy month of Ramadan, many will be engaging in social activities with their brothers and sisters, including iftars, communal prayers, and events aimed at propagating Islam to non-Muslims. But in recent years, we've seen the Zionist lobby and its collaborators in the Muslim community propagating efforts that on the surface appear to be harmless interfaith events, but are actually attempts to normalize the Zionist regime to Muslims around the world. In this week's episode, we'll look at how these attempts are made and we'll explore what Muslims must do to remain alert to them. First, we take a look at some specific examples of the kind of individuals and organizations that are engaging in such normalization actions.
Interfaith denotes a harmony for all and elevates the idea of coexistence. However, in recent years, they have become vehicles for normalizing Zionism in the Muslim community. The peaceful, multi-faith community-building exercise has been hijacked by some in the hopes of weaponizing the goodwill between believers in the Abrahamic faiths. One such group is called Nisa'at Nashim, a Muslim and Jewish female-only network that engages in superficial-level discussions on religious matters, in the hopes of utilizing the friendships formed under the banner of interfaith harmony and worship to silence criticism on Israel. In an event they held over preparations for the holy month of Ramadan and the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, they repeated that we must celebrate what our similarities are and respect our differences. They later clarified that this statement was not regarding theological differences, but specifically in relation to the settler colonial Israel. However, this is not surprising, as the pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews admits that it incubated Nisa'at Nashim for this purpose. Not only is this group funded by the Board of Deputies, but also by David Dangor, whose family also funds the Islamophobic Henry Jackson Society. Such infiltration requires Muslim accomplices. The co-founder of Nisa'at Nashim, Julie Siddiqui, is also the co-founder of the Big Iftar and works as a Muslim interfaith consultant for the Kosher Iftar, established at a pro-Israel synagogue. She has a long history of working with the British Armed Forces, which she has openly stated is something we should be proud of. Critics say that personalities like Siddiqui are the Muslim face of Zionism and hugely damage the value of interfaith work in multi-faith, multicultural societies like the UK.
Now, joining us on the show this week to discuss this extremely important topic are two very special guests. We are honoured to be joined by Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer, the founder and director of Peacemaker Trust, a UK charity dedicated to peacemaking, especially where minorities are persecuted, where justice is denied and human rights are suppressed. Stephen is also chair of the Covivencia Alliance and the director of the Institute for the Study of Christian Zionism, as well as being a member of the executive of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He's a retired Anglican priest, but continues to serve as chaplain to the former Bishop of Jerusalem, Bishop Riyah Abul Esel. We are also pleased to welcome a favourite of the show back, Sayyid Ammar Kazmi, who helps run the Left Legal Fighting Fund, a legal defence fund which focuses on assisting anti-racist, anti-fascist, and anti-Zionist individuals and groups who need legal support. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to you both. Reverend Sizer, if I could start here with yourself, how would you define interfaith and what are the benefits of such dialogue and events?
Interfaith is about people of different faiths coming together to understand one another's background. It's not about proselytism, it's about complementing, collaborating on issues of common concern, whether it's poverty or racism, extremism, or in a case at the moment, Gaza. It's about listening rather than speaking. It's about empathizing, putting ourselves in the shoes of the other and finding what we have in common common cause and then working together to ameliorate, whether it's natural disasters, human suffering, or extremism.
So then what would you say the Zionist movement seeks to achieve by engaging in interfaith, in what some have described as soft war strategy? Why are they spending time, effort and money perhaps speaking to people who may oppose their ideology?
Well, we've just been describing what I would call authentic interfaith dialogue, where we treat one another as equals, respectful, and seeking to understand one another. The kind of interfaith dialogue that the Zionist movement engages in is very different. It's along the lines of, we set the agenda, and therefore you cannot criticize Israel. So it becomes a tool to suppress human rights, suppress challenging Israel's actions. So, for example, in the UK, we have the Council of Christians and Jews, CCJ. But in reality, it's the Council of Christians for Jews. It never criticizes the Jewish community, never criticizes Israel. It's used as a means of suppressing Christian critiques of what Israel does.
And Ammar, if I could turn to yourself as well, and maybe first ask you the same question, that what does the Zionist movement seek to achieve by engaging in such interfaith? And also maybe touching on any personal experiences or professional experiences you've had when dealing with these types of events.
Well, as Reverend Sizer was quite eloquently explaining, you know, there's nothing wrong in principle with having interfaith dialogue. In fact, you know, particularly between the three Abrahamic faiths, I think there's been lots of interfaith dialogue and discussion over many centuries. This is not really something new. The issue is really in terms of how the Zionist movement and the state of Israel in particular seeks to weaponize this term interfaith and this idea of interfaith dialogue in order to serve its own interests, which really is has manifested itself in terms of infiltrating, you know, Muslim communities, trying to essentially get them on board with the idea of being friends with welcoming Zionists who are openly Zionists into their communities, into their mosques, breaking bread with them. And that has a kind of insidious effect because, you know, if you're talking with somebody and you're becoming friends with them and you're becoming friendly with them under the guise of interfaith, but really this person is trying to promote Zionism, it could help to compromise that individual, that Muslim or that Christian who's speaking to them in a very sort of soft way, because the next time that person sees atrocities happening in Gaza, in Palestine, or, you know, wants to criticize Israel in any way, perhaps they might think twice. They think, well, you know, I met this person and they seem to be pro-Israel. Maybe I don't want to offend them. I don't want to disturb these interfaith community relations we've developed. So this is actually one of the strategies. It's not necessarily just about open proselytism and saying, you know, you should defend Israel because of this, that, and the other. It's also about trying to compromise people through their relationships. And this is sort of the most insidious factor that the Zionist movement and the Zionist interfaith industry, you know, has.
And it's almost like trying to disarm people, if you will, by default, really, as you mentioned there. Just staying with yourself, Ammar, what's the danger in the holy month of Ramadan in particular. Of course, at the moment, billions of Muslims around the world are observing Shahr Ramadan. What kind of events do you see the Zionists seeking to exploit? If you could expand on perhaps some of these types of strategies.
Well, there are a plethora of these interfaith organizations within Britain. And so during this holy month of Ramadan, of course, you know, I was just talking about breaking bread. This is the perfect opportunity to try to organize things like interfaith iftars, invite different sections of the Muslim community who may be completely unaware. And this is the problem. There's a complete lack of curiosity, lack of skepticism, and indeed a naivety when it comes to this. And so, you know, you have Muslims and mosques being invited to these interfaith iftars and, you know, in a spirit of, you know, brotherly or community generosity. And so it's essentially a time in which the interfaith faith-washing industry is able to turbocharge its agenda within the Muslim community, because at this point in time, you know, Muslims are quite vulnerable in the sense that, you know, many Muslims begin becoming much more active in terms of their religious practice, in terms of their attendance at events, their attendance at mosques throughout the country during the holy month of Ramadan, and it's an opportune moment to take advantage of that, basically.
Thank you, Sayyid Ammar. Dr. Saiza, now, obviously you are an esteemed member of the Christian community and a reverend, of course, as well. Have you ever been maybe invited to or attended or, you know, been part of an event, and maybe it's become clear to you later on, hang on a minute, this may be, you know, engaging with Zionists or something? Has that been something that people have tried to reach out and maybe pressure you to engage in?
Do you mean in terms of from a Zionist perspective?
Or? Yeah, like just in terms of, you know, maybe some groups reaching out and saying, we want to do some interfaith, maybe before, you know, your views on Zionism were perhaps as well-known as they were.
To be honest, no. I think most of the times I've engaged with Zionists, it's been in a situation where they've tried to challenge me or debate with me. So I've made several programs with Zionist TV stations, radio stations, where they've tried to trap me, tried to engage with me. But I think they gave up trying to win me from the very beginning. I think I've been involved in lots of interfaith events and opportunities, particularly with Jewish and Muslim friends, where we're genuinely trying to find areas of common ground that we can work together.
Yeah, and I think that's key. It's you know, sincerity and genuinely engaging with people who aren't trying to use interfaith, which some actually prominent Zionists in the UK, for example, have openly said, we use interfaith as a way to make the case for Israel in a church or in a mosque, and describe the kind of disarming tactics that Ammar was alluding to as well. Now, of course, Ayin Islam did speak to people in London to ask them their thoughts on the attempts being made across the world to normalize the existence of the Zionist entity in the name of interfaith.
I think that interfaith is a good thing. It's good to kind of get to know other faiths and what they're doing, and it builds those connections to start conversations. I think that we have to differentiate between kind of interfaith events and opportunities to network and connect, and almost creating that network to buffer down and silence a lot of our own opinions and a lot of our own viewpoints, with this idea that because we're kind of connected and friendly, it gives us kind of puts us in a bit more awkward situation, position to kind of speak up about what we believe in. So I think that it's a good thing, but within our boundaries and with our kind of understanding of what we can talk about and what we can't.
Any multi-faith projects in that context would have been used as a kind of form of submission, in the same way you might see it in geopolitics, where certain countries may say we're looking for forgiveness, peace, friendliness, etc., but ultimately it might be lending itself more towards submission or to acceptance of oppression. I think we shouldn't assume that there are normalization projects, for example. We should look at each case critically, and there are a lot of things that we don't want to politicize as Muslims, but ultimately, if our enemies, we know them, they are politicizing it, we should look out for those cases and be ready to treat those cases accordingly.
The sort of events where a point of view can generally be put across, where we're building up allies so that they can defend us in our times of need, and those are of course positive events and positive things that we should do. But if there are events where it's just tokenism and it's just a whole bunch of chaps patting each other's backs and nothing actually being achieved in the long term, then I don't see what the point is.
Now, Reverend, if I could come back to yourself. We know that initially Zionism was an anti-Semitic, kind of evangelical Christian project, if you will, before it was a so-called Jewish one. Can you elaborate more on that?
Yes. At the end of the 18th century, Napoleon was at war with the British. French and the British were competing to control North Africa, the Middle East, and our trade routes to our colonies and other parts of the world. And Napoleon was the first world ruler in 2,000 years to promise the Jews a homeland in Palestine because he wanted the wealthy Jewish bankers to back his war effort against the British. So he set the price on Palestine. He was unable to deliver, but by the 1820s, British politicians were recognizing the need to secure the support of the Jewish community to help defeat the French and then eventually the Germans to control Palestine, because Palestine's the bridge, if you like, between the continents. So the race was on to control Palestine. So it was driven by some who were philo-Semitic, who genuinely loved the Jewish people and felt they should be returned to the land of their origins in fulfillment of Bible prophecy. But the anti-Semitic element was either implicit or explicit. Implicit in the sense that they were a tool of British colonialism. Mm-hmm. You know, the Balfour Declaration promised the Jews a homeland in the British Empire. It didn't promise them a state, didn't promise them independence. We weren't giving land away in the beginning mm-hmm. of the 20th century. The explicit anti-Semites just wanted to get rid of the Jews mm-hmm. out of Europe, out of Britain, and plant them in the Middle East. So the Zionist project, the Christian involvement, preceded Jewish Zionism by at least 50 years, more than that. And today, 9 out of 10 Zionists are Christians. Yeah. John Hagee, for example, one of the leaders of the Christian Zionist movement in the States, said, imagine 50 million evangelical Christians in America joining in common cause with 5 million Jewish people in America. It's a match made in heaven. Mm. He's put that 10 to 1. So you've got that heavy emphasis of what is now American foreign policy rather than British foreign policy mm-hmm. to maintain a presence in the Middle East through the Israeli state.
And what's interesting is, you know, actually perhaps both sides aren't very complementary of each other, because from what I understand, those evangelical elements believe that, you know, the Jews must be forcibly converted at the end of times, and you know, the Talmud has less than complimentary words about Jesus and Christians, for example. But there seems to be this marriage of convenience at the moment between these two sides. And also, it's interesting you mentioned the British state, because, of course, they promised the homeland. But then there was this campaign of terrorism by groups like the Haganah and the Stern Gang and the Irgun, who attacked British politicians and statesmen and the King David Hotel on that road to getting their independence from Britain. So just interesting that whilst we see this philo-Semitism, actually under the surface, there's been a lot of violence, particularly from the Zionist movement. Sayed Ammar, if I could come back to you. And we saw earlier, of course, Muslims in London. They are clearly aware of the disguise, if you will, being used by these normalization projects. But what role do collaborators in the Muslim and Christian community, for that matter, play in terms of how they enable this agenda?
Well, the role of collaborators is absolutely vital, not just in faith washing, but also more broadly in terms of furthering the interests of nefarious actors, be it, you know, Islamophobes within the British state or elsewhere. Without those sort of collaborators, the sort of good face, if you like, of this activity, there wouldn't be the depth of infiltration within our mosques and our churches. And that's principally because the people who are allowing them into these spaces are the people very often who are leaders in our community, people who are trustees of different buildings and centers, And so it's them who are principally responsible for allowing these Zionist actors into our spaces, and also promoting it within, you know, the Muslim community as something harmless. And actually, I have to say, I think that it's largely a case of naivety than it is of malice, because I think when Muslims and Christians, who by and large are very, you know, peace-loving people, who love their, you know, brothers in faith in terms of the Abrahamic faiths, when they see this issue of interfaith, they think, well, of course, we, you know, have lots of common ground, we are monotheistic, we have, you know, we believe in many of the same scriptures and prophets. So why wouldn't we try to have a dialogue to engage and get to know each other better and work on various issues that are of mutual interest? For example, when it comes to Muslims and Jews in particular, issues around burial rights are very important. It's important for Jews and Muslims in local areas to, you know, have a dialogue when it comes to their councils in terms of arranging those issues to do with funerals, for example. They see this and think, well, why wouldn't we be involved? But there is a lack of curiosity and, as I say, a naivety about some of the broader aims being pushed. And of course, there are those people who we shouldn't give the benefit of doubt to, who, you know, have been very active in this interfaith peace washing and faith washing industry for a long time, you know, exactly what they're doing. So those actors are completely critical in terms of giving the Zionist movement the depth that they have within our Muslim and Christian communities across the world, but, you know, particularly in Britain and the United States.
And Amar, if I could just stay with you as well, due to the environment of hate and pressure that we're seeing placed on the Muslim community, they're guilt-tripped sometimes into participating in normalization projects, maybe to prove their innocence and to prove they aren't anti-Semitic. How do you advise Muslims, and indeed, again, Christians, to proceed when faced with these types of infiltration attempts and these pressure attempts in our communities?
Well, I think I can only really speak on in terms of Muslims, because I think we have there are some particular issues with our community, which is that by and large, the Muslim community is made up of immigrants and descendants of immigrants in Britain. Of course, there are many people who converted to Islam, but principally, you know, say comes from a population that doesn't originate, you know, from Britain, as it were, at least in sort of the last sort of 60, 70 years. And so there are multiple issues at play. There is, for some people, there is an issue of thinking of being sort of grateful guests, if you like. I like this term, grateful guest syndrome. They think that they don't really have any power or agency in Britain, and so they are at the behest of the British state and all of these various interests, and if they don't accommodate them in some way, then, you know, they could end up being deported, they could have issues in terms of their, you know, immigration status, they could be put on lists, they could be targeted in some way. So that's an issue that I think is particular to the Muslim community more than it is to the Christian community. But also, I think it's a lack of confidence in one's own convictions, because if you are catching wind to the idea that basically this is being used to sort of leverage Zionist interests within the Muslim community, and you don't do anything about that because you're scared of potentially the charity commissioner is going to come after you, maybe you're not going to get funding from, you know, the Home Office or something like that, and so you end up compromising on your religious ideals to promote that, then that's really a question of a lack of religious conviction, and indeed of, in some ways, you know, it might be considered by some to be a strong language, but I think it's absolutely appropriate. It's kind of a treachery to your own values, never mind to your fellow you know, community members.
Yeah, absolutely. And Reverend, if I could ask you the same type of question, what advice would you have to people who are faced with, I mean, you've come under immense pressure and kind of campaigns by Zionist organizations. What advice would you have to others in terms of standing strong, if you will?
Find out more. Reach out. If you're breaking your Ramadan fast, invite neighbors, Christians, Jews, to join you. Find out who they are, what you have in common as parents, as grandparents, as in your communities. Reach out and find out more about anti-Zionist Jewish organizations, for example, the Jewish Network for Palestine or the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, to Jewish organizations I'm involved with. The Convivencia Alliance brings together three faith communities to work for justice and peace in Palestine, or from the Palestinian Christian perspective, organizations like Sabil or Kairos, because people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Mm. And we have so much in common that is far more than the things on which we differ. We are stronger together, and that's why I would encourage those listening our program to engage in interfaith dialogue. You have nothing to lose, so much to gain.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your wonderful insights, Reverend. And of course, as well to you, Brother Sayed Ammar Kazmi. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. And I'd like to also thank you at home. You can join us again next week for another edition. Assalamu alaikum.